Lottos, sitting in for Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The superiority of black athletes has long been a fair topic in the locker room and film comedies such as White Men Can't Jump. In the more politicized world of national media, though, it's a taboo subject. Oddsmaker Jimmy the Greek Snyder lost his job as a CBS commentator for saying that blacks were bred to be better at sports. Dodgers exec Al Campanis got fired for claiming blacks didn't make good managers. A long history of racism and eugenics is background to both of these pronouncements and the reaction against them. A history so horrible it'd be no surprise if no one ever revisited the topic. But as Yogi Berra said, it ain't over till it's over. The TV producer turned freelance journalist John Entine has reopened the old debate. In a new book, Taboo, Why Black Athletes Dominate Sports and Why We're Afraid to Talk About It, Entine argues strongly that it's nature, not nurture, that makes the world's best athletes. And nature strongly favors people of African descent. Entine's book reviews the genetic, population, and medical science surrounding the issue and concludes that certain African populations and their descendants have an inborn advantage in some sports. Entine's book goes further, looking through the history of these arguments and carefully debunking previous racist beliefs. We're talking this hour about race and sports on The Connection. Is America ready to tackle the genetics of athletic success? Is there a genetic component to black athletic success? Does it matter in the broader American conversation on race? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, makes the race and sports connection. We're joined now by John Entine, author of Taboo, Why Black Athletes Dominate Sports and Why We're Afraid to Talk About It. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Why don't we start by letting you make the case? Let's hear the thesis.
Well, the thesis is that, and this is not controversial, by the way, in the scientific world, it's that essentially humans are different, that different populations evolved under different circumstances, and as a result, they have different body types and metabolic structures, and those qualities actually make athletes different. And so we might have West African descended athletes who are great sprinters and jumpers, and we might have Eurasian whites who are great wrestlers or weightlifters, all because of different evolutionary histories. And again, that's not a very controversial subject in the scientific world.
It sounds so simple, but yet it's so complicated politically.
It is politically very, very controversial, and understandably so. I mean, the history of colonialism, racism, and genocide sets a pretty bleak picture for discussion of this issue. And there's no question historically discussions of race and human differences have been used in pretty nefarious ways. And that's one of the things I tried to put in context in the book.
Let's hear about some of your research on this. Tell us about a medical study, for example, that you felt was the convincing piece of evidence for you.
Well, actually, I mean, one of the questions I think you're going to ask in the course of this is why does this even matter? And that's really when you talk about what medical studies and scientific studies I've looked at, the best studies are really involving disease. We now know because of genetic discoveries over the past 10 or 15 years that different populations are susceptible, genetically susceptible to diseases. And that's very clearly defined by science. For instance, Ashkenazi Jews are much more likely to get breast cancer or Tay-Sachs disease, while blacks are much more likely to get colorectal cancer and sickle cell anemia. And these are very population-specific diseases. And basically the argument or the point I raise over sports is no different. Different populations have different have had different developmental histories. And when you look at West African body types, which is really what African Americans, where they trace their ancestry to is West Africa, you see a very distinct musculature, skeletal system, and other body functions.
Relating to speed and ability from your point of view, or from the medical studies point of view?
Absolutely. And again, very few people go about studying the genetics of athletics. It's just not that popular a subject. There have been studies going back to the early part of the 20th century about body type differences. And you can, again, go back to the 1920s. And it's very clear that different population groups, and we're not just talking about blacks and whites, and in fact, no one even uses the term black or white now because that's a pretty simplistic folk concept of race. We talk more about populations and population clusters, and within Africa, the differences between East Africans, West Africans, North Africans is quite dramatic, both in body type and genetically. We really see differences that have been documented quite clearly, and only recently, as genetic research has become more sophisticated, can we begin to link some of these very clearly documented what are called phenotypic differences to a genotypic basis, a genetic basis.
Do you want to do some of the statistics?
Well, the anecdotal statistics on the playing field are pretty wild, actually. One of the most interesting is, again, the understanding that people who can trace their ancestry to West Africa are better runners and jumpers. And there's no better sport, I think, to look at than sprinting, which requires, very, very little equipment. The socioeconomic barriers to being a great sprinter are very, very low. It is the most international of sporting events. And you look at the top 200 100-meter times, and every single one is held by a person of West African descent. There's not one white. There's not one Asian. That's pretty remarkable anecdotal evidence. No white person has ever broken 10 seconds in the 100 meters, and dozens of West African-descended athletes have, including one athlete from Namibia who's done it 26 times.
Yeah, but respond to the counter-argument that has been said in this case, that what the statistics you're citing and the anecdotal examples that you're citing are far from conclusive.
Well, then DNA tests are far from conclusive because they make a standard DNA test look like, a chance occurrence. Obviously, that's not what you'd call an airtight proof, because in science, you don't have airtight proof. Science is about circumstantial evidence. How do we know that the Earth revolves around the sun? Well, that we don't know. There's no airtight evidence on that. It's circumstantial evidence. Many of the theories of science that we have are not observable phenomenon. They're based on a series of circumstantial proofs. And frankly, we have overwhelming anecdotal evidence that there are differences between populations, and all the science points in the same way. It's not like there's 60% of the evidence points one way and 40% points another way. All of the evidence, scientifically and anecdotally, point in the same direction, and that's what scientists call consilience. It's pretty overwhelming, and frankly, I couldn't get a scientist who would challenge this thesis. Everyone that I spoke to, different countries, different races, population geneticists, molecular biologists, anthropologists, all, I think, believe this is not a particularly controversial theory. It's just controversial politically because of the echoes of racism.
Do you feel that your theory runs contrary to the notion that blacks excel in sports for cultural and environmental reasons?
Absolutely not. I mean, there's no question that...
How do they factor in?
Well, it's everyone wants to say, okay, what kind of role does genetics play? Is it 63% genetics and 37% environment? Well, we can't parse this kind of information out. We do know that genetics and environment are intimately related. I use the term in the book a feedback loop. Ultimately, one reinforces the other. A great example is sprinting, I think. Years ago, when the level playing field didn't exist in sprinting or in running or in any sports, and there were far fewer athletes, black athletes who went into the sport, a lot more white athletes competed in it, and whites did okay. Actually, blacks have dominated sprinting for pretty much the entire century, but there were a number of instances where whites were competitive. But as the playing field gets more and more level, and the opportunities are open to more and more races, actually the playing field looks more and more segregated. Blacks are dominating, and whites self-select out. They no longer pursue sports like sprinting, and frankly, they're selecting out of basketball and football to a large degree, or at least the speed and jumping positions, because they know that the chances that they'll compete successfully are lower, and ultimately end up weeding out people who probably could have competed quite well. Environment gets exaggerated by these, or environment exaggerates these small genetic differences.
What about things that are more intangible, the drive, the determination, the need to win exhibited game after game by the likes of Michael Jordan and Larry Bird, that were as much a part of their personal winning formula as how tall they were, how fast they were, how smart they were, or whether they had red hair or whether they had black hair?
I mean, you're right on the mark there. Absolutely. There's nothing. I'm saying nothing about the individual athlete. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of Michael Jordan wannabes with Michael Jordan talent who are, playing on the blacktops of America, who just don't have Michael Jordan's drive and intelligence, tenacity. Michael Jordan is Michael Jordan, and athletes, by their very definition, elite athletes, have some qualities, intelligence, drive, personal qualities that are fundamental to their success. What I'm saying is that think of genetics as a house almost. It's the structure of the house. It sets some kind of limits, but all the important stuff is the furniture that you fill it up with. And the personal qualities of an athlete and their commitment to being great is really what makes them a great athlete. But they do have limits. There's no way that if you don't have the innate skills, that you're going to be a 4-4 sprinter, no matter how much you try or how much you train. And the reality of it is that the pool of, again, using West African athletes as an example, that the pool of great sprinters and jumpers is a lot greater among people with a West African descent than it is among any other population, including East Africans, frankly, who are terrible. Hapless at sprinting, pretty much.
Connection listeners, where do you come down on this idea? Where do you stand on genes and athletics? 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Give us a call. Sam is on the line. Sam, thanks for calling The Connection.
Hi. I don't find this controversial at all. I understand the point about genetics and using it for positive benefit with research and disease and so on and so on, and I understand discussion in that case. I'm totally befuddled by what his point is about sports. I understand what he's saying about NBA and the black athletes, but what's his point? Are we supposed to put handicaps on Michael Jordan, or why is this discussion going on?
I think the discussion is going on because it's a phenomenon that people are interested in. I don't think that every book that's written, every analysis that's made requires a public policy reaction to it. I think there's a lot of curiosity about what we see on the playing field, and people want to understand why. And basically, I've addressed the question of what's behind the phenomenon that we see.
So you don't have any suggestions about it? So it means nothing. It's just a picture. It's not like the disease case where you're proposing some benefit or some direction that it could bring benefit besides, the observation brings no benefit then.
Well, it may bring benefits. I can give you one example of a benefit, and it was raised by Bob, frankly, and that's people self-select out of sports based on stereotypes, and I think that's wrong. I think people should recognize that individual achievement is the most important thing, and that in fact all racial groups can compete at all sports. And I think that's one of the lessons that comes out of my book, if you read it, because it's I think Bob raised this point. My book is as much a socio-history of the concept of race and how it's been abused and misused historically. I think one of the reasons that taboo has been so widely acclaimed by African-American scholars, and there's an African-American who wrote the introduction in the Journal of the African-American Male, which is carrying an excerpt of this, is because it really destroys a lot of the stereotypes, the racist stereotypes about this issue. And that's, I guess, what I'm most proud of in this book.
Sam, can I ask you a question? Does it make you feel uncomfortable to talk about this, make you feel uncomfortable that the subject is even raised?
No, I think genetics and molecular biology and nature and nurture are very deep subjects. In fact, I'm reading a book, Lifetime and Memory, that's about, exactly about that, but in a wide sense of a science. I think this is just taking one facet on it and, like, pricking the needle a little about in a very narrow subject. I think books that discuss it in the broad range and in ways in which it helps us live together or find ways in which to improve things and learn are fine. I think this is just a very small thing that, in fact, is just re-aggravating the old. It's the flip coin of this, whoever it was talking about athletes being bred better, the black athletes being bred better, and so on and so on. I think it's obvious. I love sports. I'm white. I can't dunk. And I love watching the NBA. I just don't see what this discussion brings.
You know, you say it's obvious, but people, you know, all the time, especially in the media, say it's not obvious. So clearly we haven't reached the point that we can openly discuss this. And again, I think what sports provides is an access point, an easy way to understand this issue that isn't provided by even medical research. There's only one winner in a race. Many other areas where we talk about genetics and genetic differences are far more complicated than the sports world. And in fact, the book is a very broad take on this issue. It doesn't just talk about sports. Someone who has no interest in sports could read this book and come away with a great understanding of evolutionary history and the genetics of human biodiversity.
Sam, thanks for your call. Let's go to another 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Eskinder, you're on The Connection.
Yeah, I enjoy your program.
Thank you very much. Chris Lydon, thank you very much.
I'm from Ethiopia myself, and I just want to reinforce the idea that being discussed in your show that genetics, environment, different body type, even different diet and geographical location as they relate to climate do matter in sports and in various kind of activities. For example, coming from Ethiopia myself, I know that the best marathon runner in the world are either from Ethiopia or Kenya for the last 30 years or so. And I think your speaker would agree with that, as he has seen in the last few years here in the Boston Marathon, who is the real winner. And it is so because the environment and the diet of that particular geographical location does matter in terms of running. I want to mention that perhaps the best marathon runner of the century may have been a person from Ethiopia by the name Abebe Bekele. Sport historians indicate that in the late 60s and 70s, this person was running the whole 26 miles without a shoes. And
Bekele actually won the 1960 Rome Marathon.
Exactly, Rome
not,
in Tokyo.
not wearing any shoes, and then won again in 64.
Exactly, and I just want to mention that a well-known Italian journalist once said that it took 200,000 soldiers to conquer Ethiopia, Italian fascist troops, that is, and it took only one man to conquer the whole of Rome.
Well, you're making a
Abebe Bekele.
John Entine, you write about the Kenyan long-distance runners in your book, such as Ibrahim Hussein, who won the Boston Marathon in 88.
Absolutely. He makes a wonderful point here, which is the danger of using terms like black and white. They're much, much too simplistic, and I make the point in the book that we're talking about populations here, and there's probably no greater difference in body type and ultimately in performance on the athletic field than East and West Africans, where West Africans, you know, again, are speedsters, higher percentage of fast twitch muscles and a body structure that leads to jumping, while East Africans, Ethiopians and Kenyans, are by far the best endurance athletes in the world, Kenyans especially. But as he mentioned, there's been some fantastic Ethiopian marathoners over time, and that's the result of evolution. Ultimately, things like diet and geographical location have become adaptive changes and passed along into the genetics, and we see that.
Well, when you write about the remarkable runners who live around, and forgive me if I'm pronouncing it wrong, Eldoret, Kenya, you also write about the fact that the kids there run all the time everywhere, barefoot to school, for example, and that's more cultural and environmental than genetic, isn't it?
That is, but it's an interesting chapter because I really try to paint a very non-polemical picture of the issue. But I interview also Wilson Kipketer, who's one of the best middle distance and long distance runners in the world today, and asked him, you know, what about this theory that Kenyans are great runners because they run to school every day? And he laughed and he says, well, I live next door to the school and I used to walk real slow. So I think it's a little it's a little much to make a judgment that the reason is environmental. No question that there's a lot of cultural aspects of Kenyan culture and Ethiopian culture that reinforce what's in their genetics, but this is a chicken and egg issue here. Which came first?
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Join the race and sports connection. Eskinder, thank you very much. Brian, you're now on the connection. Hi there.
Hi, yes. The speaker was talking about a level playing field, and I was just wanting to say that you really have to look at the larger picture of the level playing field as far as the relative opportunities for people classified as black or people classified otherwise. Currently in this society, there are restrictions on the opportunities. And when you have a situation like that, you're going to see blacks overrepresented in sports, like you saw women overrepresented in the occupations of teaching, nursing, and secretaries for such a long time. But there's not necessarily a genetic or biological basis for it, because race essentially is a social construct. This has been proved. It's not based in genetics or biology. To look for a population geneticist argument for that, I'd say look to Luigi Colli-Sforza and Marcus Feldman at Stanford. And for scholarly discussions, I would reference the Mismeasure of Man and all the scholarly debate that followed the publication of the Bell Curve.
Well, this is part, John Entine, this is part of the debate here, whether blacks excel in certain sports because it's the path of least resistance, so to speak, that down the other path they're denied opportunities.
Yeah, he actually raised two questions. One is that, and I think there's no question that opportunity is a major player here. In fact, I have a chapter in the book about Jewish domination of basketball in the 1920s and 30s, when more than 50% of the top players in semi-professional basketball were Jews. That's clearly an environmental a factor, because Jews were very dominant in the urban culture, though, interestingly enough, many sports writers and even some scientists suggested that there was a genetic reason for that, and that's because Jews were trickier and more manipulative and craftier than other so-called races, and that's why they dominated. So, you know, there's always an environmental factor, and in sports, there's no question that blacks have not had many opportunities for a long while. Now that they do, and sports tends to be one of the areas where they have where it's more open to them than others, so they're gonna move into those areas. But to say that there are environmental reasons for it does not say that there are no genetic reasons for it. And in fact, few scientists would say that, which really leads to the second point that was raised, which is Cavalli-Sforza's work. And if you read Cavalli-Sforza carefully, and I have, and talked to many population geneticists, including Kenneth Kidd at Yale, and a number of molecular biologists and anthropologists like Vincent Sarich at Berkeley, none of them dismiss the concept of population clusters. And frankly, race is a social construct, but population is not. Race is a very generic folkloric term that includes things like facial color, but no one, no scientist, no geneticist, and my book's been looked at by, I got a blurb on the book from the president of the Human Biology Association, no one suggests that there aren't populations who have evolved under very particular conditions and therefore have very specific morphological phenotypic structures that make them different.
Well,
this is not controversial.
That's the danger of talking about populations and then also talking about blacks. And the work that Cavalli-Sforza and other people separated the two, and that's because there's more genetic variation within the category that's classified as black than there are between other races, other groups that are classified as other races. So you could have two people classified as black socially that are so genetically different that they're, one might be closer to white and one might be closer to Latina genetically, even though they're both classified as black, just because of the social atmosphere. So there's definitely genetic variability that allows people to succeed better in sports, individuals on an individual basis, or even you could look at population clusters of certain genes that make people taller or run faster. But then associating with black is the political and dangerous approach, because then you're immediately tying it to something that is not genetic and to something that is just a big political issue that can raise a lot of questions and definitely raises the specter of racism.
John, well, you said,
yeah, first of all, black is genetic. Color is genetic, believe it or not. Whether race, as you just defined it, is has a genetic component might be somewhat controversial, but not particularly in the scientific world. I agree with your premise that using terms like black and white is a little indiscreet. And I think if you read the book, I'm very careful, despite the title, which is obviously you can only say so much in a title. The book is much more refined than using concepts like black and white. And I have a whole chapter, for instance, called, you know, What Color is Black, to try to look at some of these issues. But you use a what I find is a cliche, which is that there's more difference within races than between races. And that's genetically, we now know that's a meaningless statement. I deal with that in the book. I mean, there's more difference within the and height issues between within women and within men than there are between women and men, but no one would dare suggest that men aren't taller than women. You can still make group generalizations based on population differences. Actually, Stephen Jay Gould's argument, Richard Lewontin's argument, Jonathan Mark's argument, they're very much political arguments, and in fact, they make a point in their statement saying we are taking a political point of view. They are not taking a genetic point of view. Their research is quite outdated and not considered very accepted in the genetic community.
John Entine is author of Taboo, Why Blacks Dominate Sports and Why We're Afraid to Talk About It, more in the second half of the show. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI, Public Radio International.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about the thorny topic of race, genes, and sport with TV producer turned freelance journalist John Entine, whose new book, Taboo, Why Blacks Dominate Sports and Why We're Afraid to Talk About It, weighs in heavily on the side of nature in the nature versus nurture debate. John Entine, even for the sake of discussion, it's true. Why should we care? Shouldn't we be sitting in front of the tube watching Women's World Cup soccer with our daughters, praising the goalie not because she's black and that makes her quick, but simply rather because she's a heck of a netminder? What's important about this? What does it matter?
Well, I think you're right. We should be praising people for their individual achievements. And the last thing I'm trying to do is trying to steal that from people. This is just a inquiry of understanding. I think people want to understand how the world works. A lot of research is for those reasons. And why do people read poetry? Why do people read fiction works? Because they want to understand the world a little bit better and have a more complex understanding of humanity. And that's really what this book is about. Look, genetics is in our face right now. The Human Genome Project is within a year of mapping all 140,000 human genes. This is one slice, one access point to understanding the role that genetics plays in human nature, and that's exciting. It's the Copernican Revolution in come to genetics.
Let's talk to Connection listeners, 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Bodu, you're on The Connection. Thanks for calling.
All right. Thank you very much. First of all, I really love your show. I would like to disagree, first of all, with the African fellow who called. I myself am from Africa, too. I'm from Senegal. And this sort of discussion, bringing genetic into the discussion, I think it's misguiding or misdirecting the discussion in the proper way. It is doing so precisely because it undermines the social and historical analysis. Can you, for example, argue that Brazilians have more genetic makeup to be good in soccer? No, I don't think any common sense Scott, I would say so. Brazil bring people like Romario or Pelé precisely because in Brazil, soccer is everything. Everybody plays soccer everywhere all the time. That's the same with the African in Kenya. That's the same with the black people here in the hood. That's what they do. When they're kids, they don't have these bunch of toys that these white children have. So they grow with just a ball and a hood. And it's logic that the hood here in America brings some people like Michael Jordan in numbers. You know, I don't see any genetic function to the debate.
John Entine.
Well, in Mexico, I would say despite the popularity of soccer, the national sport is baseball. They're fanatic about this, and yet Mexicans don't make great baseball players because they don't particularly have the body type for it because of their native Indian genetic part of their body type. So if the point you're making is that body type doesn't play a role, I think that's not accurate. If your point is that culture plays a huge role, we know that that's true. We know that that a lot of Kenyans want to be runners because they know the history of Kipchoge Keino, who was a great a 10,000 meter runner and a national hero in Kenya and throughout all of Africa in the 60s. But we do know that genetics plays a part, and frankly, we know it in Brazilian athletes as well. This is, again, not controversial in the science world. It's just controversial to talk about politically. It's the question is, how much is nature, how much is nurture? We don't know.
Modu, anything else for John Entine?
Excuse me, sir. The example he gave is not that quite a good example to define these genetic or these social roles, because if you bring some people who are naturally not fitting for such particular sport, it's like when you go to where people call pygmy, which is derogative, but when you go to the pygmy population, even though they would like basketball, they're not that tall. So it would be obvious that a great basketball player will not emerge from that population. So that's this kind of comparison that you're making with these baseball people, these people who like baseball and not producing great baseball players. It's not an accurate comparison.
Well, the point I was trying to make is that just the passion for it, the desire for it, and the cultural commitment in Brazil for soccer alone is not enough to make you a great soccer player. There's got to be some genetic component to it. And in fact, we do know that the genetics of Brazilians is a key factor in why Brazilians have become great soccer players. In fact, that's been talked about. And I talk about some of that in the book as well.
Modu, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. George, you're now on The Connection. Thanks for calling.
Thanks very much for taking my call. Very interesting. And I want to talk about one aspect of this, which is a wonderful topic. It's called curiosity. I think this intrigues a lot of people talking about genes. And one of the very peculiar events that involved the Olympics was a gentleman by the name of Peter Uberoff. I don't think it was genetic, but he actually made a profit when they ran the Olympics in Los Angeles. And what Peter did was funnel the money back into the training camps so that they would bring enterprising and young talented people. Fortunately, by the grace of God, that included my son. And I think there was a curiosity factor here because my son Kent was the Massachusetts triple jump champion, and he was obviously white Caucasian. And they said, well, he holds the records. Let's find out what he's all about. So they brought him to Lake Placid, and make a long story short, he learned a great number of things while he was there and became the Massachusetts State Decathlon champion. Now, I was obviously very proud of this, and I mentioned this to my father, who I hadn't seen in about 18 years. I said, Dad, you're going to be very, very surprised to hear this. I said, but Kent was the Massachusetts State Triple Jump Champion. And he said, he's gone on to become the decathlon champion. I said, I know you're surprised to hear that. So he says, oh, no, I'm not surprised at all. I said, well, why aren't you surprised? My father's very athletic, I should mention. He says, oh, no, my great uncle was the English triple jump champion back in the early 40s. Well, his name is Holgren, I believe, and I was so decimated by this. But I think it does show that it does have genes as part of its component. So I want to thank everybody for having the curiosity about this topic. And I think there is a very, very important element of genes that comes into play here.
George, thanks very much for your call. John Entine on that?
He makes a very good point. I think one story that I like to reinforce this is in Kenya, where we had talked about how what great middle and long distance runners they are. Because of their success in running, the Kenyan government a number of years ago got the idea, hey, if we've been so successful in the longer races, why don't we go after sprinting? You know, clearly there's a pool of athletes here who are great runners. So they've been pouring tremendous resources in a country with not a lot of resources into developing great sprinters. And what's happened? For all intents and purposes, Kenya is hapless at sprinting. They have a couple of runners who are okay at 400 meters, but there are no elite East African athletes, whether from Kenya, Tanzania, or Ethiopia, who are great elite sprinters because they don't have the genetics for it. There's a limit on that, and I think we see that pattern all around the world, whether it's Asian gymnasts and divers, or Eurasian wrestlers and weightlifters, or East African endurance runners. Genetic sets limits.
John Entine, let me ask you a question that comes out of the title of the book, Taboo, Why Black Athletes Dominate Sports, and Why We're Afraid to Talk About It. Although we don't seem to be so today, why are we afraid to talk about it?
Oh, we are afraid. I think when people talk about race, the cerebral cortex cuts down, no question about it. And we're afraid to talk about it because this is a country built upon a commitment to equality. And sometimes we assume that equality of opportunity, which is what the United States is about, means absolute equality about everything. I think there's been a belief since World War II and the genocidal nightmare of Nazism that any concept of race directed at whether it's Jews or blacks, frankly, comes to no good end. I think that's the reason people like Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Lewontin have taken a political stand in discussing this issue, because we don't trust human beings, frankly, in dealing sensitively and competently with such a complex issue. It's dangerous, slippery turf here. The reality of it is, though, that it's turf that we're back on because of the Human Genome Project, so we better discuss it in a thoughtful and reflective and sensitive way, despite its potentially dangerous uses.
Once you isolate a genetic distinction, even an advantageous one, the field is open to search and find disadvantageous ones. That's what Richard Bernstein wrote in the New York Times book review of your book.
Absolutely. There's no question this stuff can be used in nefarious ways. And frankly, genetic differences never are separate from environmental influences. For instance, we look at something like sickle cell anemia, which is much more prevalent among African Americans and blacks in general. And only one-tenth of the people who have the genetic predisposition for sickle cell get it. Why? Because there's an interaction between genetics and the environment. So we can never separate these things. And when you start doing so, then you're starting to get into the political dimension of using this information. And when you get start traveling down that path, it almost always has come to a negative end, which is the danger of using this for public policy reasons.
Back to the phones and back to the connection listeners, 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Ralph is on the line now from South Bombay, New York. Hi, Ralph.
How you doing? Thanks for taking me on. I'm going to be quick. I'm Ralph from South Bombay by way of New York, by way of Western Pennsylvania, and I trace my ancestry back to slavery in the United States for many years. So I'd like to ask three questions. First, the eugenics of slavery, about the Middle Passage, and as it was resulted in Cuba today. I love your program, and I love the gentleman's approach. Spell your last name, Eugene, so I can get the book.
Entine. John Entine is E-N-T-I-N-E. John, go ahead.
Well, he raises the issue of the Middle Passage. For people who aren't familiar with that, that's the essentially the bringing of Africans, West Africans, to the United States as part of the slave trade. It's referred to as the Middle Passage, and this became a hot-button issue 10, 12 years ago when Jimmy the Greek Snyder, who was a prognosticator, not a very good one, on CBS Sports, made a crack on Martin Luther King Day. That blacks were bred to be better athletes in slavery times, and they cited the so-called Middle Passage, where the The hardiest didn't survive, and then in slavery, where supposedly blacks were bred to be better athletes. And it sounds very plausible, but frankly, that's it's not a very authoritative theory. Science just doesn't support the theory that that there was any breeding going on, whether because of the slave trade or because of selective decisions by slave owners. It just didn't happen. The science doesn't support it. The evolutionary impact of body types that we're talking about has occurred over thousands or tens of thousands of years, and a couple of hundred years hasn't been enough to really set the tone on something like that.
Ralph, thank you for your call. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Tim is on the line now. Tim, you've made the connection. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. In fact, my question follows on from, partly follows on from the previous question. When I used to study this years and years ago, the case was often cited of the difference in eye vision perception of the average Japanese, which has been civilized allegedly for in excess of 4,000 years, and the average eyesight is very poor. Compare that with the current modern-day Kalahari Bushman who still hunts for a living, and he has fabulous visual acuity because if you can't see your prey, you can't eat it. Now, the question I had really was what is the implication of genetic attrition where, we're all subject to small modification mutations all the time, and if you don't have a very aggressive selection pressure on that, then, you get a less fit form emerging. Now, if one could trace one's ancestry back to a hunter-gatherer of only 200, 300 years ago, perhaps that person hasn't had the same genetic load placed on it that a Western person or perhaps, who hasn't hunted and gathered for a living in 3 or 5,000 years. And I wonder what the implications of that were.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there's no question that there are different evolutionary pressures on different groups, and the more insular the population, the more likely that you're going to see much more distinct genetic patterns. And I think what we definitely see today, as the world is much more mobile, is that we're going to see a dilution of insularity and a dilution of genetic and phenotypic differences between populations. But it's a slow movement in most cases, though. An example that you gave, where a very, very insular culture was suddenly opened up to the West, obviously it's going to be accelerated.
John, do you worry that that your book and your writings play into some of the worst stereotypical racial notions, that excellence in sports is measured by the physical performance?
Well, I don't think the book does that. I mean, anyone who reads the book and comes away with that belief, read the title and decided to make a judgment before reading the book, I think actually my book goes a long way to destroying those stereotypes. And again, the reason I think it's been embraced by so many African American scholars is because of it's very much a dissection of the pretty dark side of the human debate over race over many centuries.
John Entine is the guest. He's the author of Taboo, Why Black Athletes Dominate Sports and Why We're Afraid to Talk About It. Back to the phones, 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Ashok is on the line now. Ashok, thanks for calling The Connection.
Thank you. John, you've made a distinction between nature and nurture, and the moderator has suggested that you've come down on the side of nature. You cite people like Lewontin and Gould, but perhaps you've also come across the work of academics like Susan Oyama, who make the case that forcing this dichotomy between nature and nurture probably isn't the most constructive way to approach the issue and probably doesn't make the most sense. You yourself, John, have mentioned in the program that nature and nurture are very closely related, and that certain, I presume you would agree with the point that certain genetic traits are expressed under certain environmental conditions, and certain environmental conditions can impact the genetic traits that are expressed. And so I guess my question for you would be whether by coming down, quote, on the side of nature, whether you're actually perpetrating or prolonging a debate which is outdated in those terms, and perhaps it makes sense to use a different paradigm. And the second question I had for you was that you pointed out that in your book you somehow encourage people of different populations to try to succeed in basketball or running or what have you. But I don't understand how your argument could legitimately encourage a non-West African to try to become a world-class long-distance runner.
Well, on the first part, I think we're in absolute accord. I really don't think I come down on the side of nature and nurture. I go a long way in the book to saying that they are inseparable, that the concepts, very concept of nature and nurture are linguistic concepts, which is the whole basis for saying that those kinds of concepts like race and even gender are to some degree social constructs. There's no way you can parse, delineate nature from nurture, because in essence they are inextricably linked, and there's an artifice between them. So that is a very key point, I think, in the book. I just try to make people understand that a genetics plays a role, and I think a defining and delineating role in setting limits. That's about as far as I go, and I spent quite some chapters actually talking about this. As for the second question about whether I'm encouraging people, I'm explaining. I am. This is part of a conversation, and frankly, the conversation is continuing here on this program. Science is about asking questions and refining those questions, hopefully pointing to being more and more sophisticated about human understanding. And that's really all I'm trying to do. Whether it encourages or discourages someone, I can't take personal responsibility for. What I'm trying to do is taking personal responsibility for putting out accurate, in-context information about a very controversial subject and trying to diffuse racist stereotypes and simplistic viewpoints, and hopefully more understanding will come of that. I believe it already is happening in just shows like this, where we have a pretty open and vibrant conversation without anybody trying to impose their point of view.
Ashok, thank you very much for your call. John, hang on for another. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. Shaylor, you're on the line. Thank you.
Good morning. I would like to ask Mr. Entine, how much does the environment influence genetics?
I think we've touched on that quite a bit so far. Go ahead.
Yeah, just very much. They're not separable from each other. Many genetic issues, and I talked one about the incidence of sickle cell anemia. Again, only 1/10 of the people who have the proclivity for sickle cell actually get it, and that's clearly triggered by environmental factors. So you never can separate the two, but we do know genetics plays a role, and that if you don't have the genetic proclivity for that disease or many other attributes, including certain athletic skills, you can't get those diseases or become an athlete with which those skills are highly in demand.
John Entine, I thank you so much for speaking on this subject today, especially on this day when race is so much the topic.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
John Entine's new book is called Taboo, Why Black Athletes Dominate Sports and Why We're Afraid to Talk About It. You've been listening to The Connection on WBUR Boston and PRI. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in today for Christopher Lydon.
Are available for $15, including shipping and handling. To order, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287.
funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Alaire Corporation. PRI, Public Radio International. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by ClearPoint Consultants, Inc., offering employment opportunities on the North Shore for recruiting professionals. www.clearpnt.com. My limerick.